Hello everyone, this is Dark Journalist. Today we're going to be joined by Oxford scholar Dr. Joseph Farrell for a deep dive into the genesis of the deep state and how it has controlled our lives for over a century. Dr. Farrell's new book, McCarthy, Marshall, Roosevelt, and America's Progressivist Deep State, explores the roots of our current political turmoil and societal dysfunction. Today we'll also explore how secret societies, the UFO file, and assassination have been the deep state's tools for global domination and the control of space. Here we go. Dr. Joseph Farrell, the genesis of the deep state. Joseph, I have to say it's great to have you back.
I like this quote on the back of the book, by the way. This must be a product of a great conspiracy, a conspiracy of infamy so black, when it is finally exposed, its principles shall be forever deserving of the maledictions of all honest men.
Mm-hmm. He didn't mince words. Yeah, it's... I think probably when he said that may have been sometime around 52 or 53, if I recall correctly, when he's in the thick of it and, you know, calling all of those people in front of his committee, in particularly with relationship to Monmouth and GE and all of that stuff that I covered in the first book. It was quite a little nest that he was on to.
I know, it's incredible. And it's interesting too, because if you are traditionally interested in history, when you run across McCarthy, you're mm-hmm. going to be so turned off mm-hmm. by that sort of overlay of mm-hmm. the witch hunt mm-hmm. and, oh, how many lives did he destroy and that kind of thing, that you'll miss what that fight was all about.
Right, right, right.
Which is a pretty big problem.
Well, it's a big problem. We need to remember, you know, that the narrative that's been put out about him and the reality are very, very different. There's no question in my mind, you know, as I've said before, that he was a shameless opportunist. But by the same token, he, you know, as Arthur Herman put it, and I pointed out in the first McCarthy book, he didn't destroy emails. He didn't raid the opposing party's political headquarters. He didn't kill anyone. Bodies don't drop around him like flies in less than coincidental circumstances and statistically improbable circumstances. So, you know, we've got to get rid of this idea that he's just this paragon of evil. But by the same token, when you look at his background, there's very clearly a right-wing connection to the man. I mean, he's connected with the Texas oilmen. He's got that connection to Robert McCormick at the Chicago Tribune. He's got the connection to the Harnischweger family in Wisconsin, which was very clearly, you know, openly pro-Nazi before the war. So you've got some group that's behind him very clearly. And, you know, his association, you know, you call Roy Cohn the original swamp creature, which he certainly was. No doubt about that. You know, when you look at Roy Cohn's early activities before he hooks up with McCarthy, you know, talk about a man that's out to destroy lives.
Wow.
You know, the famous case of Abe Feller at the United Nations that commits suicide, you know, well, Cohn was going after him long before he got involved with Joe McCarthy. So yeah, McCarthy's an interesting fellow, but you know, we have this idea that he's destroying lives and, you know, the Hollywood witch hunts. Well, he had nothing to do with that.
Right.
He, you know, his whole shtick was he is concerned with why are these known security risks, which the Truman administration itself drew up, are they still employed in the government? That was really his only big concern. And the deeper he, you know, the deeper he dove, I can imagine with someone with his memory, You know, he was had an extraordinary memory, and he was a workaholic. I think maybe he was perhaps even obsessive compulsive. I mean, the guy was just this bundle of energy, and I think by the time he got deeply into it, that even he probably was not expecting all of this stuff that, that you find in the transcripts of his committees. So there's clearly something going on with the man. And the more I think about it, Daniel, the more I think that, yeah, you're watching two deep state factions play out a drama. And he was kind of Donald Trump version 1.0. And he's fighting another kind of left-wing entrenched deep state faction on the other party. So, and as I say, and we'll get into it, I strongly suspect that there's a lot of sexual blackmail going on behind the scenes. You know, McCarthy was well known to be a womanizer. You've got Roy Cohn, who's involved with David Shine during the Army McCarthy hearings. I suspect that there's a whole lot of that that has never surfaced. That we're seeing the public presentation of it, you know, in the final denouement of the period.
Amazing. If we think of those two deep states, how far back does that fight go?
I think there are at least three benchmarks or bellwethers that you could hang this fight on. I think it, the first one and the most recent one would be those voices that began to question the policies and decisions of the Roosevelt administration, people like Martin Dees of the House Un-American Activities Committee in the 30s. Beginning to question, you know, he set that up largely as a means to investigate Nazi influence. But eventually it came to his attention that, you know, there's all of these communists or sympathizers that are getting jobs in the federal government. So he turns his attention to that, much to the displeasure of Franklin Roosevelt. So I think you'd have to look at the 30s as being the first kind of benchmark, and that carries forward. After the war, when they go back and they start investigating Pearl Harbor, they, you know, you've got the McCarran Senate Judiciary Committee that really begins what McCarthy would become famous for. So think of Senator Pat McCarran as well. But you go further back, I think the other benchmark is Woodrow Wilson, Colonel House, and that whole first progressive administration, and the very heavy hand that Wilson wielded during the First World War to create a centralized economy, to use the anti-sedition laws to quash any opposition to the way he was running the war, running the country. Right. You had, with the Federal Reserve System, the income tax system, you had people pointing out that as a problem. I'm thinking of Congressman McFadden, you know, again, another congressman that's questioning this progressivism. And then I'd go, you know, if you want the first real benchmark is, I think, the run-up to the Civil War and Abraham Lincoln, the opposition to his huge expansion of the federal government. So those are the three benchmarks, I think, that you have to look for this kind of deep state cultural conflict. But certainly the one that has had the most influence on us is Franklin Roosevelt. Yeah. Because here's a man that deliberately broke with tradition, ran for a third term and then a fourth term. So he had an ability to shape the culture of the federal bureaucracy as no other president before or since.
Right.
And I think we're looking at the long-term effects of that now. Mm-hmm. I really do. I think that, you know, what we see going on with Donald Trump and the struggles with the so-called deep state, it's just a continuation of all of this from the 50s.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's one of the key players in your book.
Oh, yeah. Yes, he is. for a little reason named Roy Cohn.
He has that info. He has that intel.
Well, Roy Cohn, you know, he was there during this period. And he did, from time to time, release a little tidbit of information, you know, like that business about Senator McCarthy having been on a list of four senators that these three men from the military approached with the idea of suggesting going after these security risks. You don't find that anywhere else other than Roy Cohn. And, you know, whatever you say about Roy Cohn, he's not a fellow to make things up, you know, of that nature. So, yeah, he was there. He was in the thick of it. And let's remember that in the case of the Monmouth transcripts, they were only declassified in 2003. So the only ones that would have known what those transcripts contained was Roy Cohn. Mm-hmm. And he could easily, given the fact that he helped Donald Trump build the Trump Tower, paved the way for that little phenomenon, you know, there's no telling what Roy Cohn might have shared with President Trump by way of information. There's no telling. And I happen to think he probably shared quite a lot. Trump is too canny to be reacting to this gale of opposition without having a little inside information.
Right.
At the way that the game is played. So, you know, I look at this as just a continuation of this battle that we've seen since Franklin Roosevelt.
Amazing. And Trump has three key connections. Mm-hmm. Roy Cohn being principal, mm-hmm. his uncle, John,
right.
And who's connected to all Tesla and Vannevar Bush.
Right.
And then Nixon.
And Nixon, right.
Those three mm-hmm. very much inform what he's doing with the presidency.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think so, too. The Nixon just stop and consider the fact that Roger Stone was connected with Richard Nixon and, you know, connected up with President Trump.
Right.
And again, I don't think that connection is by happenstance or accident. You know, I'm one of those that thinks that Richard Nixon pulled a fast one, you know, when he resigned. That as the secret honor movie that I told you about suggests, is that they were pressuring him to run for a third term.
Yes.
And he just, you know, refused. I think there's a lot going on here that we have yet to see, you know, the final results of or to get all the information. But Roy Cohn and his uncle in particular are in a position to give Donald Trump a lot of information that most presidents, if you stop and think about it, Daniel, most presidents entering office in the presidency as an entry-level position. but seriously, most presidents wouldn't even have that kind of information readily available to them that he had. Not Ronald Reagan. The only one I can think of that probably would have been G.H.W. Bush. Mm-hmm. But other than that, John Kennedy didn't have that kind of information going into it. Certainly Dwight Eisenhower didn't. Harry Truman, you know, shows up for work one day and the president's dead and he's president. You know? So, you know, I doubt that Truman had that kind of information available to him when uh-huh. he entered office. So Donald Trump is very unique in this respect. He's got a lot of connections that were in a position to give him a lot of information.
Wow. Did Henry Wallace come up in this? I had some unusual things about Wallace, mm-hmm. one of which was his relationship with Nicholas Roerich mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. his tight connection with this whole Russian, you know, there's like a Shambhala somewhere out there, mm-hmm. and Rorik being kind of a Russian agent in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a weird one, and I came across a letter from Roosevelt to Wallace where they're talking about the masters, mm-hmm. and that's kind of like an ascended masters type thing. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, Rorik, Russia, ascended masters, Roosevelt, mm-hmm. and his VP, future VP, Wallace.
Mm-hmm.
And Wallace runs in that 48 election,
yes. against
Dewey, but he says a progressive.
Mm-hmm.
So weird mix there.
It's a weird mix, and it's always been extremely curious to me as to why Roosevelt drops him.
Yes.
In 44. And what I have read about it suggests to me that the Democratic Party establishment was not happy with the prospect of Franklin Roosevelt dying and ending up with Henry Wallace, you know, a kind of a Bernie Sanders of the day, you know, as president, because Wallace was very clearly sympathetic to socialism. And you have, in addition to that, as you say, you have his occult interests, which were well known to people in that period. So I'm thinking, you know, they persuaded Franklin to drop him from the ticket and to pick up Harry Truman for precisely that reason. There's a lot going on behind the scenes with all of this. And the other problem that I think may have been in their mind is there's that episode I talk about in that second McCarthy book of General Marshall going to Governor Dewey and telling him, please don't mention this business of American foreknowledge of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. That would complicate things. It would expose security risks and so on. And, you know, Dewey's first reaction was Franklin Delano Roosevelt needs to be impeached for what he did. But then he changes his mind and doesn't mention this during the campaign. Well, I suspect that this was another reason for putting pressure on Roosevelt to drop Wallace. They did not want any of that to be exposed, which, you know, of course, eventually happens with Elizabeth Bentley and Whitaker Chambers and the House Un-American Activities Committee and so on. And then, of course, Senator McCarthy. But I suspect that they were already anticipating, you know, we're going to be facing some major blowback after President Roosevelt dies. So let's minimize the risk and dump Wallace, get him off the ticket, and let Harry Truman bring in his people, you know, which he does. So I suspect there's a lot going on behind the scenes with Vice President Wallace. Absolutely.
Wow. Incredible. Well, this is probably the key point around the book, which is you mentioned something about the other international.
Right.
We all know your references, and you developed the fascist international, the mm-hmm. Nazi international, and mm-hmm. we know its deep state effect in America. Mm-hmm. What is the nature of this other international, and what kind of a deep state is it?
Well, good question, because you'll notice I left it deliberately undefined in the book. And that was very deliberate, because if you look at the constellation of forces around communism, obviously you've got Comintern, the Third International, which at that time, of course, is under Joseph Stalin's control. Then you've got Trotsky's efforts to form a Fourth International in opposition to Stalin. So what I'm talking about the other internationals, first of all, communism, particularly in its conspiratorial international manifestations at the time. But I'm also talking about the financial deep state machinations that are going on behind all of this, because clearly you have Wall Street involvement in getting the Bolsheviks into power. You've certainly got some sort of big finance behind Leon Trotsky,
mm-hmm.
So I'm talking about that. And let's not forget that Stalin himself, and this is the oddest thing about all of this, Stalin himself, when he starts to hold the purge trials in the 1930s, if you look at who he's going after the old Bolsheviks. He's going after essentially Lenin's Politburo. Mm-hmm. Because all of these people that are hauled up to these trials, Bukharin, Kamenev, on and on the list goes. And of course, Leon Trotsky, really being kind of the center stage in absentia. Stalin is actually saying in these trials via the Soviet state prosecutor Vyshinsky that, yeah, there is an organized Trotskyist opposition inside the Soviet Union. So he himself is saying there's another international. Now, everybody at the time, you know, with half a brain that was looking at these show trials was saying, no, this is all trumped up charges, and pardon the pun, and that there's no reality, there's no material reality to it. But since the collapse of the Soviet Union, the opening up of some of these archives and so on, it does appear that some of these people were engaged in some sort of ad hoc informal effort to depose Stalin and shift the Soviet regime back into its original Trotskyist, Leninist internationalism. And we'll say more about that as we go on. But, you know, Stalin himself is really saying, okay, there's my Comintern, and then there's something else.
Right. He's almost acting in the role of McCarthy in a weird way.
In a weird way, he is. And in a weird way, if you look at what Stalin is actually doing and the policies that he reverses that Lenin and Trotsky had initiated, Stalin, in a certain sense, could be looked at as kind of a fascist version of Bolshevism rather than the international version. In other words, Stalin very clearly rejected Trotsky's idea that we need to expand the revolution globally and we need to do it now. And Stalin's approach is, no, we need to establish socialism here in Russia first before we start thinking about exporting it. So, in other words, he's a fascist in that sense. Mm-hmm. It's national Bolshevism rather than international communism that he's all about.
Right.
And he reverses several interesting policies. He reverses Lenin's new economic policy, which was essentially a kind of quasi-capitalist policy to get the Russian economy off of its legs. He reverses that, implements the collectivization policy. He reverses some of Lenin's strictures against the family. In other words, Stalin is all about Russians having more Russians, you know, and so on and so forth. So it's a very peculiar thing. But there's been, including some Russian scholarship, there's been a bit of revisionist scholarship concerning the show trials that does suggest that there was a genuine reason for Stalin to have been concerned about an effort to overthrow him. For example, and this is well known, in the May Day parade of 1937, there were unusually many more NKVD, which is the precursor of the KGB and the successor to the Cheka. There were several NKVD divisions in Moscow for the May Day parade. And if you look at what is going on and the way that Stalin is reacting to his coterie after the parade, it's clear that he was fearing some sort of coup attempt may have been launched against him using all the troops that were in Moscow for the parade. Hmm. So there does appear to have been something going on. And what I think is going on, and I found this, Daniel, in a book totally unrelated to the purge trials. It's a book by a German historian by the name of Paul Carell. And it's a book about the war on the Eastern Front during World War II. It's called Hitler Moves East. It's an excellent, excellent study of the first 2 years of the German invasion. But he points out something very, very interesting, that in December of 1941, during the German offensive on Moscow, there was a German infantry regiment that had tapped the phone lines of its Soviet counter, and they heard the Soviets talking about something called the Khabarovsk Lot. And at first, the Germans thought, well, this is code for some operation or some organization. And they later learned, after they had captured some Russian prisoners and queried them on what this reference referred to, well, it referred, the Russians told them, to Marshal Mikhail Tukhachevsky, who was one of the people that Stalin had purged in the purge trials. He was one of the five marshals of the Soviet Union in the 1930s. And intriguingly enough, he and Stalin had already had a run-in during the Russo-Polish War of 1920. Because you'll recall that the Polish marshal, Joseph Pilsudski, had marched the Polish armies all the way to Kiev, you know, and was going to stake out Greater Poland. And Tukhachevsky, who had been put into command by creator of the Red Army, Leon Trotsky, Tukhachevsky was a brilliant commander. He marched the Poles, fought them all the way back to Warsaw, and issued orders for the army on his left flank to march towards Warsaw. Stalin was the commissar of that army at the time, and overrode Tukhachevsky's orders and had them wheel away from Warsaw toward the Polish city of Lvov. And, of course, that saved Marshal Pilsudski. And so Tukhachevsky had good reason to hate Joseph Stalin. Anyway, the Khabarovsk Lot was the name for Tukhachevsky's Siberian army. And this is very interesting, because what he did, because he was an opponent of Stalin's collectivization policy, he allowed units, peasant units of the army, to locate to Siberia and gave them their own plots of land, a cow, a chicken, a few things like this, and created a little zone in Siberia where an army of 110,000 men, a peasant army, was raising their agriculture and so on. That's huge. That's about 10 divisions, folks. And this was all under his personal control. So he had a supply base for the army that was not dependent on Moscow. He had the command and control structure there. And the rumor was that eventually he was planning to use that as a military coup against Joseph Stalin. So, in other words, there was some sort of organized internal opposition, and Stalin was alive to it. And the plan, if you read my book carefully, it's very clear that Tukhachevsky was planning, probably, to use the May Day parades as the excuse to bring these units to Moscow and, you know, take control. And there's all sorts of other stuff going on in the background here, because Tukhachevsky, at one point, through an intermediary, had contacted the Polish military attaché, or pardon me, the Japanese military attaché in Poland, to ask them what they would think about that, you know. And the Japanese put all of this information in a diplomatic pouch to Tokyo, which was intercepted by Stalin's NKVD. So there you are. So in other words, bottom line here, folks, is that in spite of Trotsky's denials that he was involved in any such plot to overthrow Stalin, it does appear that there is a plot of some sort in the Soviet Union. and that Stalin takes advantage of that, not only to liquidate the plotters, but get rid of all of those old Bolsheviks that he doesn't want hanging around that have their Trotskyist leanings. So, you know.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it is. It's totally different version of what we've been, you know, taught to believe about these purge trials, that there wasn't an ounce of credibility
to
what Stalin was claiming.
Stalin being
as a matter of fact, there was.
Right. This makes me think about the czars.
Mm-hmm.
And is this some kind of an attempt to recapture what was going on before the czars got thrown out?
What do you mean, recapture what?
Well, when the czars were taken out of power,
mm-hmm.
It seems like a lot of different forces were scattered away. Like, we know about this little white Russian community.
Okay, that, yes.
Yeah. So, does this have anything to do with that?
Well, in a way, yes, because what you're looking at with Tukhachevsky, with Marshal Tukhachevsky, and again, I have to emphasize, this was a very, very capable military officer. He was not like Marshal Voroshilov or Budyenny. He was not a Stalin crony that knew nothing about about military operations. This guy knew his stuff. Tukhachevsky was the marshal that was responsible for defeating the forces of Admiral von Däniken during the Russian Civil War. And then he turned to the Ukraine and defeated the white Russian forces in the Ukraine. So in other words, he earned the gratitude of the Soviet regime because he was literally the one that saved it.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, he was himself a czarist officer at one point. He was of noble blood. In other words, he was a nobleman that threw in his lot with the Bolsheviks. So there is a czarist connection to all of this.
Yeah.
And again, Stalin, you know, you've got to put yourself in that paranoid shoes. Stalin's thinking, oh, my God, Tukhachevsky, you know, he could bring back the czar. You know? Which, knowing Stalin, probably occurred to him on occasion.
Resurrection there. Mm-hmm. It almost seems like it's a royalty government in exile figuring out how to get back in.
Perhaps. You got to wonder, particularly under Putin, you know, with the Romanov eagle prominently displayed, you know, and all the talks in the Russian Duma. Hey, you know, let's get the Romanovs back here. Who knows?
It's interesting you mentioned Putin. I'll just bring this up for a moment, which is he brought in this idea that he may run to stay in there till 2036,
mm-hmm.
which is quite a run since he's been in there since 2000. Mm-hmm. He's basically brought back this idea of the long-term communist yeah. dictator.
Yeah, he has. You know, and he gets all sorts of vilification in the Western press. I don't think, and I never have thought, that Putin is a kind of a neo-Stalinist. He's not that. Mm-hmm. He is an authoritarian, clearly, mm-hmm. but he's not a return to the Soviet Union. I think you have to interpret the symbols that he surrounds himself with very, very carefully. In a certain sense, he could be viewed as kind of a neo-Stalinist in that, like Stalin, his policy is Russia first. Right. Russia first, not this globalism stuff. So in that sense, he does resemble Stalin. But Stalin, Stalin's an unusual guy because he, by the same token, as he's going through all of these purges, and people have to realize, I mean, he literally gutted the Red Army officer corps. I mean, just absolutely shredded it.
Yes.
If you wonder why the Red Army performed so poorly in the initial stages of World War II, that's part of the reason.
Uh-huh.
You know, you could be shot, literally, if you didn't perform well as an officer. And there were occasions of that. Stalin is unusual because at the same time he's pursuing this Russia first policy and eliminating the old Bolsheviks, at the same time he is revivifying the idea of Comintern, of an international global communist conspiracy, which, you know, is clearly there. I mean, it's there's no two ways about it. Mm-hmm. And Trotsky's trying to do the same thing, you know, establishing his Fourth International. So he's a bit of a mystery, and you have to kind of thread your way through this very, very carefully. But anyway, I didn't mean to get off on all of that.
Yeah, fascinating. I was always amazed at the Stalin-Hitler pact and Ribbentrop and all the things that they did to keep that together. In any case, it always seemed to me to be quite shocking that they made the pact in the first place.
Well, there's a school of thought out there that thinks that Stalin was hoping, and I tend to think that it has some traction, given the way that the Red Army deployment was on the day that Hitler launched the invasion of Russia, because the German officers commented at the time that it looked like the Red Army was in deployment positions for offensive action. So in other words, I think Stalin's hope was that Hitler would get embroiled with the Western allies and, you know, they would fight it to the death and he could just kind of roll in and take over. That didn't work out according to plan. Hitler had other ideas, it seems. But there is a school of thought, and I think it does have some traction.
Well, these are all threads kind of in the background of
right.
the book that you came out with. And this book is interesting because although it is part two of the McCarthy-Monmouth hearings book, which is a fascinating breakthrough, I think, because we're also dealing there with advanced technology.
Oh, yeah.
And it's kind of amazing that Cohn, this central figure helping McCarthy, and not to mention RFK in the mm-hmm. middle of all that, mm-hmm. They're privy to this. Mm-hmm. And Project Blue Book comes up in those
yes.
hearings.
Yes.
What was it? Going back to the first book on this, that they were trying to get at, do you think, on McCarthy's side with the Monmouth hearings?
Well, the Monmouth hearings, I'm quite convinced, began because in my reading of it, Senator McCarthy has some sort of intelligence coming to him from the Venona project, from the project to decrypt Soviet secure communications to agents in the United States and Canada. And I've long suspected that this is via J. Edgar Hoover. Now, I'm not saying that McCarthy is sitting there reading the actual decryptions. What I think probably was the case that Hoover being Hoover is summarizing these things in his memoranda that he would occasionally compose. And that's what McCarthy is getting. In other words, Hoover is telling McCarthy, look here, look there, look, and McCarthy goes out and does it. Uh-huh. So he goes to Monmouth because it has been brought to his committee's attention that there were cells operating at Fort Monmouth, Ethel and Julius Rosenberg being the most famous instance of a connection to Fort Monmouth because they had part of their cells in that facility.
Right.
So he gets started on this, but in the process of the transcripts, you find Cohn and McCarthy asking these bizarre questions that clearly indicate that they are privy to some information that has nothing to do with communists at Fort Monmouth. Like, you know, why do the radar experts at Fort Monmouth decide to go to, New Mexico in July of 1947?
You know? It was a very big year.
Yeah, that was a very big year. That was a very big month, you know. Think Roswell here, folks. And you can tell just by the way that they're asking the question that they're not mentioning that kooky flying saucer story. They're mentioning the date and the time period and what were you doing there and what really were you researching and so on and so forth. So they clearly had some sort of idea that something was going on at Fort Monmouth way beyond communist infiltration. It's very, very clear.
Yeah, it's amazing. And that they wanted on the record that Blue Book should be caught in and that Blue Book security should be questioned.
Right, yeah. Blue Book folks does appear by name in those Monmouth transcripts.
Amazing.
So, in other words, UFO is squatting front and center in the middle of one of McCarthy's committee hearings. And again, you can tell that McCarthy's concern here, given everything else he's been finding about shoddy security, is okay, we've got this secret UFO project, and what are the security procedures you've set up around this, you know? Joe McCarthy's the last name that you would ever expect to be connected to UFOs, but there it is.
Right. No, I've never seen it before.
No.
Absolutely not. I would also say that the manner of the questioning, especially when Cohn gets his hand on the mic, it is such hardcore interrogation.
Yes.
It's to melt them down from holding and getting rid of that wall of secrecy. Tell me about the UFO file.
Right, right.
That's the impression.
I absolutely think that that's part of it. And given the fact that at the same time they start probing into this occupation money scandal, I suspect very strongly that they suspected that there was a connection between the two. Because if, you know, let's go back to the fact that Senator McCarthy in 1946 was on the committee examining the German POWs that had committed the Malmedy massacre. I suspect that McCarthy, given his memory, which was just it was on the level of Roy Cohn, you know, that they both had these phenomenal memories for detail. I suspect that McCarthy is thinking, okay, we've got Nazis, we've got technology, we've got UFOs, and we have a lot of missing money. Right. you'd have to be a dunce not to think that there might be a connection between the two.
Right. You know? He's the first missing money guy.
Yeah, he's the first missing money guy. Joe McCarthy, go figure. But yeah, you read these transcripts, Daniel, and it's like you say, there's stuff going on in between the lines, and they are hedging their questions very carefully, but they are drilling down very, very hard. Uh-huh. And they're trying to get a straight answer out of the military. And in my reading, this is ultimately why the Eisenhower administration and the Pentagon set him up for the Army McCarthy hearings, because they have to shut this guy down. Because if he keeps probing, sooner or later, some witness is going to go before that committee and say something we don't want to be said.
Right.
That to me is very clear. And everything else, you know, have you no sense of decency left, sir, blah, blah, blah. All of that's show.
Right.
This is a real knockdown, drag-out fight. And McCarthy, as I point out in the second book, is willing to take it to the second level and say, okay, let's look at Pearl Harbor. Let's look at the Roosevelt administration's foreknowledge. Let's look at who was behind the installation of George Marshall as Army Chief of Staff and find out about his connections. In other words, McCarthy is signaling to the Army that he's willing to take it to the next level and tie it to the issue of communist subversion in the government. That's a huge bombshell to drop.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Well, you've pointed out, too, that McCarthy, in essence, was a very kind of obscure senator from Wisconsin.
Yeah, he was almost totally unknown outside of Washington and his performance during the Malmedy hearings in 1946. He was very obscure.
Yeah.
And, you know, as Roy Cohn points out, he was approached at some point in November of 1950 by a troika of military intelligence people. And then you add to this, you have McCarthy's own claims that he had met with Senator, with Secretary Forrestal in 1946 when he arrived in Washington. So I think what you have in the military, and particularly with Forrestal, is you have a group of people that had looked at all of these sympathizers that Franklin Roosevelt brought into the government. The Truman administration is not really doing anything about it. And they view this as a very serious issue. So they've got to figure out a way to bring it to the American public and force the issue. So Cohn reports that this troika had drawn up a list of four senators to present their concerns to, including the government's own lists of security risks. And McCarthy was on that short list. He was the last, however, of those four senators.
Hmm.
So this is the way that Cohn presents it. McCarthy looks it over, according to Cohn, kicks the tires and calls him up and says, yeah, I'll go with this. And then, of course, he gives his famous speech in Wheeling, West Virginia, that sets it all off.
Right.
So, yeah, I think he was carefully selected. And let's look at something I bring out in this second book, Daniel. If you look at Senator McCarthy himself prior to his epiphany right. on the national stage, he has a number of very, very strange connections. Number one, his home is Appleton, Wisconsin. Well, who else made his home in Appleton, Wisconsin for a while? Harry Dexter White, who is clearly implicated in the Venona transcripts as a Soviet agent of influence in the Department of the Treasury. You know, the guy that came up with the post-war financial situation, the Bretton Woods Agreement.
Right.
Well, Harry Dexter White, after he got his doctorate from Harvard, was on the faculty of Lawrence College in Appleton, Wisconsin. Now, how, if you're Joe McCarthy, do you not know of that fact?
Right.
Okay, so that's number one. All of these strange connections that meet in him, in Senator McCarthy. Number two, when he first runs for Senate in 1946, his big challenge is Robert La Follette Jr., Senator from Wisconsin, who McCarthy ousts in the Republican primaries and then later goes on to win that Senate seat. Well, why is La Follette significant? Because during the Stalin show trials, Leon Trotsky is constantly, you know, being implicated in the transcripts of the show trials as being the mastermind behind this attempt to get rid of Stalin. Well, Trotsky, of course, is in exile at that time in Mexico. And Trotsky demands some sort of international commission be composed to allow him to respond to the charges being made against him. So lo and behold, a commission is put together, and you're going to love this, under the chairmanship of the American educator John Dewey. And it's called the Dewey Commission. And John Dewey and all of these commissioners trot off to Trotsky's home outside of Mexico City and hold hearings and interview Trotsky. Trotsky's allowed to have his counsel and so on and so forth. But interestingly enough, one of the commissioners on the Dewey Commission and the individual who actually draws up the final report for the Dewey Commission is, guess who? Suzanne La Follette, who is a cousin to Senator Robert La Follette. She's part of that Wisconsin family.
Right.
And again, if you're Joe McCarthy, how are you not aware of this fact?
Yeah.
That you have someone that is kind of essentially a Trotskyist from the La Follette family. So I have to think, okay, when Senator McCarthy runs against Robert La Follette Jr., he's being encouraged to do so by people like Robert McCormick of the Chicago Tribune. He's being encouraged to do so by the Harnischfegers and other Wisconsin conservative families. And I'm thinking, okay, they are very, very alarmed about this La Follette family and these types of connections. How does McCarthy not know about this? And again, I think he does. And I think these are some of the reasons why that troika that goes to him with this idea of making all of these security risks public, I think that one of the reasons he's on that list is precisely because they've done their homework and they've vetted him very, very carefully. There's no doubt in my mind. And there's no doubt in my mind that the reason this does not come out in most McCarthy scholarship is that people don't want to think of him. You know, we've got the narrative that he was just a demagogue smearing innocent people all over the place and, you know, finally got his comeuppance. It could be anything farther from the truth.
Right.
This was a deep state operation from the get-go, and he knew it.
Absolutely. Wow, that's amazing. You know, when I think about McCarthy, there's something from your investigations of him and what was happening with him, which is it looks like at some point people are feeding him info and he has this incredible grasp of details and resources that seemed like nobody else has. And you've raised some good explanations for how he got it. But then at a certain point, another stream enters in. And it's almost as if the first group that is giving him info wants to get rid of that communist influence, you know, and they want to really expose it. But then at a certain point, he starts getting info as if that force starts feeding info back to him to out this other kind of fascist international that's trying to get them out. And then that seems to be where the kind of idea of the public turning against him, the establishment turning on him, seems to happen somewhere in there.
Well, I think it's intimately tied to the Monmouth investigations and all of those allusions that you find in those transcripts. To Roswell, to UFOs, to money laundering and gobs of missing money and so on. I think it's intimately tied to that because it's one thing for him to go after communists, but when in the course of that he starts running into communist infiltration at a major research facility for the American military, which in its turn is tied to the events in July of 1947 in New Mexico. And he's mentioning by name Blue Book and all of these things. He's getting to territory now that the military didn't count on him getting to.
Right.
And
he's played a level on his own.
Right. It's very clear that the effort to stall him and get rid of him really begins to gain a full head of steam during those Monmouth investigations because they are the direct cause in turn of the Army McCarthy hearings.
Right.
So this to me is the hidden story. They're worried about that secret getting out somehow. And they don't want him in there upsetting the apple cart. Plus, let's remember the Kennedys are tied to him very, very closely. And Forrestal is at one point tied to him very, very closely. Wow. And all of those interests have their own peculiar UFO connections. So you look at Forrestal, he's on the MJ-12 documents. You look at the Kennedys, you've got Jack Kennedy, you know, ordering the CIA to vet its UFO files so that we can turn what is not national security over to the Soviets and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And then you've got McCarthy with all of those strange references to Roswell and the Monmouth transcripts. So it's clear, pardon me, it's clear that there's a hidden agenda of secrecy and high technology that's at stake in all of this. That's when they turn on him.
Right.
And they do it in such a way to set Roy Cohn up. And in setting Roy Cohn up, you know, they know McCarthy. McCarthy, if nothing else, is loyal to a fault to his friends. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is what the whole Army McCarthy thing is all about. And in the process of this, this is why I wrote the second book. McCarthy, in June of 1951, had given a speech on the floor of the U.S. Senate questioning the decisions that General Marshall had made during the war, which are eminently questionable. There's no two ways about it. Uh-huh. That seemed to benefit the Soviet bloc and later communist China. And in 1954, and this is what really caused me to write the book, Daniel, because I had one of those palm slap to the forehead moments of realizing that I'd overlooked a very, very obvious thing. And the obvious thing was that McCarthy took that speech that he made in 1951 and published it in a book called America's Retreat from Victory in 1954, which means at the height of the Army-McCarthy hearings.
Right.
Okay. Now, this is a typical Joe McCarthy underhanded political tactic. There's no other way to qualify this, folks. He's a politician and he's playing politics. If the Army wants to play hardball, I'll play hardball. What he did in the book is he added new information that was not part of his original speech. Ah. But given the information that he adds, you have to know that he probably knew it in 1951 and just didn't mention it. It's his ace up the sleeve. It's his trump card, okay? The information that he adds is at the beginning of the book, like the first 16 to 18 pages of the book version of the speech. And he tells you, I'm adding this information, okay? And what he does is he goes through General Marshall's military record before, as a colonel, he becomes a five-star general for Franklin Roosevelt, leaping over gobs of other people in the process, okay? Right. And he points out that Douglas MacArthur, General John Pershing, and other people who had been Marshall's commanding officers, absolutely, Marshall's military record was, let's say, in the toilet. In other words, he was not a competent officer.
Right.
So this is what sets him off. McCarthy asks, well, how is it that he became a five-star general? Well, let's look. And the first little bombshell he drops is that one of the people most influential in getting Franklin Roosevelt to leapfrog Marshall over all these other officers is, guess who? Harry Hopkins. And who's Harry Hopkins? Well, he's Roosevelt's Martin Bormann. Okay.
And Roosevelt's ear.
He has Roosevelt's ear. That's for sure. Harry Hopkins is, first of all, the guy during the war that was responsible for Lend-Lease. It's strongly suspected that Harry Hopkins even authored the bill for the Lend-Lease. And, oh, by the way, the Venona transcripts make it, again, very clear that Harry Hopkins was a Soviet agent of influence. It was, for example, according to Major Jordan, George Racy Jordan, it's very clear from him that it was Harry Hopkins who okayed the transfer of uranium to the Soviet Union during the Second World War, and also our engraving plates for occupation money. Okay, now that testimony had already been given in 1948 by Major Jordan to the House Un-American Activities Committee. So McCarthy knows this. But in dropping Harry Hopkins in there at a time when no one other than maybe J. Edgar Hoover and a few people in the U.S. Army and a few people in the FBI knew that those Venona transcripts were fingering Harry Hopkins as a Soviet agent, by dropping Harry Hopkins in there, to me, that's number one, a little signal, another indicator that McCarthy is getting intelligence from Venona.
Right.
And number two, by dropping it in there, he knows that he just lit a very short fuse over at the Eisenhower White House.
Right.
Because why? Marshall, in his turn, was the one who helped leapfrog Ike over several officers. Okay?
Yeah.
So we're dealing, you know, remember, we got to remember McCarthy's a poker player.
Right.
And a very good one, according to the records. And this is his way of doing it.
Amazing. You know, it's so fascinating. This comes out in these books so clearly. And you've laid it out about the Nazi International side, mm-hmm. and how after the war, we had these two factions, mm-hmm. which were still fighting. It wasn't mm-hmm. like the war settled that by a long shot. As we know, the Nazi International made their new base in so many different places, but South America certainly. Mm-hmm. And they were able to have a lot of those resources after the fact too that they had built up. Mm-hmm. You've made that very clear. And so we have that faction, and then the kind of communist faction mm-hmm. that we were allied with through mm-hmm. World War II, they come back up, and there are so many of them in the government at that point that this mm-hmm. is what breeds this atmosphere where McCarthy yes. can come forward and where Nixon yes. can get Whitaker Chambers and all the rest. Mm-hmm. So it's quite an interesting battle that starts to take place. And then you point out, in the 50s, it's all committee hearings.
Mm-hmm.
It is one big committee hearing to find out what on earth is going on, mm-hmm. where is the power center here, mm-hmm. and also maybe to punish enemies or to gain some advantage. Mm-hmm. And that's what you get coming out of that. And in that milieu, you have brought out the Kennedys being with McCarthy on this, mm-hmm. Bringing this information out. You've got Roy Cohn with McCarthy in this. Mm-hmm. And we really can see that just a decade later after that, we've got the Kennedy assassination. Yep. That's like the next move out after Eisenhower and all this happens.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to reflect how that battle just continued on and moved right through. And I think that we get a real clear snapshot of it now, because we have Trump in office,
mm-hmm.
and he yeah. has that the deep state support of that sliver of the deep state that Professor Scott refers to as the America First.
Mm-hmm.
He compared mm-hmm. them with kind of like almost like the John Birch American manufacturers angle.
Right.
So we have these levels, but we haven't seen that deep state this prominent in a while.
No, we haven't seen it. We really haven't seen it this prominent, probably since the Reagan era.
Yeah.
And even there, again, you still have those two deep state factions playing it out. You know, yeah. there's no doubt in my mind that the Reagan assassination was let's call it the global loony faction. That this was an attempt to take him out and put GHW into office.
Right away.
And it failed. You find the same things going all the way back to Nixon, his refusal to agree to the GATT General Agreement on Trades and Tariffs.
Right.
So this has been playing itself out for a very long time, and Trump's just the latest version of it to come along. mm-hmm. in my opinion. In other words, we're kind of looking at a long-term factional warfare that really began, I think, during Roosevelt's period and has continued up until now. And every now and then it surfaces in a very dramatic way, but it's always been present there.
Right.
And, you know, it plays itself out even as late as the Obama administration, when you found President Obama making massive personnel changes within the Pentagon, within the intelligence communities, and so on and so forth. So, and you know, Trump is the reaction to this. So it's been going on for a very, very long time. But again, I go back to the fact that Roosevelt was in the position to influence the long-term culture of the Washington bureaucracy in a way that no president has been able to since. Because what happens when you pack a bureaucracy with a certain ideological leaning, well, those people in turn are now the managers that are going to hire more people. And naturally, they're going to hire people of a similar outlook to them. Mm-hmm. So this is a real problem. And you know, you can see Trump struggling with it. And again, I don't think there's any real solution that we've seen to come along that is able to address, well, how do we balance this thing again? Because if we keep a bureaucratic imbalance the way it's going, it's only going to increase corruption. It's only going to increase the inability of the federal government to respond to the concerns of the electorate. It's going to be increasingly distanced, in other words, in its own little world, which is quite apparent. From the vast majority of the electorate, so it's a very real problem. The amendment limiting to two terms really, in a certain sense, did not help because it closed off the opportunity to push back against that influence. And Eisenhower certainly didn't help things when he basically shut down the old Taft wing of the Republican Party, which has really never recovered since then. You know, we've had attempts to revive it, Tea Party and all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. But there's no national figure of the stature that Senator Taft had to represent that particular philosophy. Mm-hmm. So it's a real mess. There's just no two ways about it.
Wow, incredible.
Joseph, just amazing. We've got a lot more to cover, so let's go right into part two. By the way, everyone can get your new book at GizaDeathStar.com. Such great material, just amazing. And subscribers now to Dark Journalist will receive part two in their inbox next week. So you can go to DarkJournalist.com now and subscribe for this amazing material. We'll be back. And next Friday night, of course, at 8 p.m. with the X Series. We'll see you all then. Thank you for joining us. I'll send an SOS to the